Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.
But most people, for the most part, when they confront fear, they back off, especially a fear that is so radical that it makes you afraid that if you keep going forward, you might be extinct. And that's a possibility of bank robbery. You walk out, there's a bunch of cops, and they shoot you dead. Your body understands this. So once you go down, you get a headache, my jaw clenching, sweaty, my hands are just jumping off the steering wheel. I want a wave of fatigue goes over me, so I can almost pass on the side of the road. Pretty intense, very intense experience. What I needed to do is I needed to get angry. I needed to summon my rage by thinking of things that had humiliated me in the past, you know, from bullies from childhood all the way to my dad and, you know, the stabbing. And then this monster would rise up in me and a level of peace, you know, struck me, you know, came over me that was transcendental, man. It was spiritual practically. I was no longer afraid. In fact, I felt I could just handle. It was endorphin high or something. It was something. I just felt like I could handle anything. I felt like a giant. And I would go and direct that rage with great efficiency and make it through those banks. I just marshaled my intensity, took it into those places, and just with my words, I can march them to the vault. I could just make them give me money. I can make a couple tellers do. Once I was so dissatisfied with the little money that this little bank gave me that even though the cops were on the way out, I just walked in the bank next door and robbed it too. I was that. That's how fearless I was, and crazy, which is partly what that fearlessness is. But that's what it was like. You had to push through the fear.
Wow.
And I did.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes. Nice
dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs.
Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
Joe, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. So, you know, I came across you by way of some of the writing you were doing on Medium, and I was very intrigued by your story. So speaking of your story, tell us a bit about your background, your story, and how that has led you to the work that you're doing today.
Okay, so, why don't we start with, I'll just go straight to the beginning, and I'll rushing through it and get you to here because I'm doing a bunch of exciting things, but the beginning story is pretty intense, pretty amazing. I was born to 16-year-old parents in East Los Angeles in 1961, and they were dropouts of high school, but my dad ended up going back to night school, and eventually he got into college, and we were being these very Protestant Mexicans in a very Catholic part of East Los Angeles among a brown sea of Catholics. But we went to church all the time. We went to church twice on Sunday, during the week a couple nights. I was raised a very religious boy. My father wanted to be a minister, so he went, like I said, went back to, got his high school diploma. Then he started going to junior college. And when I was seven, very happy kid, my little brother, a year and a half younger than me, and already really wanting to love Jesus, be loving Jesus, and maybe even thinking about being a pastor because I would gather the kids around and tell them the good news of Jesus Christ. I did this little flannel graph storyboard with them. I was already kind of preaching and teaching the word. My mother got sick when I was seven. She got a kidney disease, and for 2.5 years, our home became this horrible place where she was she was dying. Basically, they couldn't do anything to help her. By the time they found out that she was that had this disease, and they couldn't give her a kidney because her body would have rejected it. So she died when I was 9 years old. Horrible, like I said, a horrible death. Very traumatized the home, and it traumatized the home in such a way that my father, who had been a young, violent man before he gave his life to Jesus, some of the anger started coming out. Some of the violence and the brutality of his early upbringing, he couldn't mask it anymore. It was just too under too much stress. So it started leaking out, and the home became a kind of aggressive place. And he would snap and he would hit us, and the hittings became beatings. And it was a very hard time. Then my mother finally passed away when I was nine. She was 26 years old. And my dad, we stumbled along for a little while. My dad, a year later or so, he got married to a wonderful woman. I was 10 at that point. She was 20. My dad was 27. And she was a Christian woman from the church. Brenda Joyce Seal, lovely woman, Irish American, and from Central Valley of California. People were farmers, so it was in China. It was like a culture shock both ways. You know, I got introduced to an entirely different way of existing on the planet with baked granola and jam. You know, she did her own jellies and baked bread and all that kind of stuff. So my dad married this woman, wonderful woman, and she exposed me to the Bronte sisters. And so I read, Jane Eyre, Wuthering Heights. I read Victor Hugo. I was reading Frankenstein, Dracula. I was reading a lot of interesting literature, fiction that I would not have read otherwise. My dad, in the meantime, was now at UCLA, Greek classics major and philosophy major. So I was also beginning to be interested in philosophy. By ninth grade, I was getting my philosophy on. I was getting my literature on, and I was already writing short stories. So it was I already imagined that I would be a writer. I had a sense of darkness around me. The brutality in the home was still there, though my dad eventually, around this time with Brenda, a couple years after they got married, he got his own pulpit. The violence was still, still sort of urgent at home. And my stepmother was feeling oppressed by my father, and he eventually dropped out of the ministry because the home, he understood he was living a hypocritical life. That was the best thing he ever did. It was the thing I'm most proud of him. I thought moment of most integrity, but she had had enough after 4.5 years of seeing the falseness and being scared. And she left him, mid 70s. And in the 10th grade, it was really, really, really a hard, super hard time, because now he was just full of rage. There's two women he had lost in a period of 5-6 years. And he was sort of shattered with grief and rage. And he dropped out of college, and he never actually graduated. It was like a couple courses away. He went to sell insurance, but insurance was really hard to sell. He couldn't focus. He went bankrupt. And he brooded around the home like a drunk. And our life trajectory of rising up and being moving forward, and I was always working in college because he wanted to be a minister, and I was thinking I wanted to be a theologian. He finally got the pulpit, and he had to give it up because his life had been so, he had kind of, sabotaged himself. All of this was alive in the moments after the divorce, in the days and weeks and months. And soon after, we moved back to East Los Angeles. When I was in 11th grade, my dad happened to be beating me very viciously one day. And later that night, they would x-ray me at the hospital and find that I had broken rib and fractured arm. And so that day he was beating me, that afternoon, he left the apartment, and I had a concussion, but I locked my little brother, 14-year-old brother, in the bathroom. And I went to the kitchen. I got a steak knife and brought the steak knife out. And I went to the bedroom and I waited, put the knife under the pillow, and he came back to the apartment. I was 16 years old. I was skinny, weighed probably 95 pounds. And this man had been terrorizing me all my life. And he comes in there ready for round two. He stands at the door, the bedroom, and he looks at me. And I look at him in my daze. And he looks over at the other end of the room, and he sees a weight set there. He sees a long bar with these 25-pound weights on it. And he looks back at me, looks back at the weights, looks back at me with a smile, and he starts walking over to the weights. And I don't know what he's going to do. He's never used these weights or the weight bar before, but he starts disassembling them, and I wonder, damn, what's he going to do? This is like, even for him, this is a new level of, savagery. If he hits me with the bar, that's bad. If he hits me with the weights, that's even worse. I don't know what's going on. So I pull the knife out and I stand up. He looks at me, drops the weight, and he stands there and says, put the knife down, put the knife down. And I don't say anything. I'm just still. And he starts walking. I think he realizes, that I'm not going to do anything because I'm so scared and I'm not saying anything. So he starts walking and give me the knife, and I charge him. He puts a left arm up and we wrestle for a few seconds, but I'm able to stab him in the neck and I start twisting it to break the knife off and he falls on the ground. Yeah, you killed me. You killed me. He yells out and I stand over him and I say something like, you brought this on yourself. You know, I was a biblical guy, so it was probably something like, this is what your sin hath wrought sort of thing. My brother was at the front door yelling, Joey, what's happening? Joey, what's happening? And I book and we bolt out the door and we run to my aunt's. And it was a horrible, horrible moment. But my father survived. And we survived it all. We went into foster care. The authorities understood now that we needed to be taken care of. We went to foster homes. My dad was taken care of and he didn't go to, he didn't go to prison, but we got taken away from him by the county. And then my senior year, I came back home and I came back home because he had showed legitimate penitence, you know, and, you know, repentance. He felt bad. And, we knew that he wasn't going to hit us anymore. With supervision, things would be well. So we came home and I was there for my senior year, but the dam had broken. That stabbing my father with my hand, those years of rage of being bullied by him and bullied by people at school, it unleashed something in me that was so elemental that I became an angry person who would let out my anger. Now I felt like if I took out my dad, who was the man who'd been abusing me, strangers had no play with me. They had no play. They meant nothing. If they bothered me, I could attack them. And over a course of a few years, I lost my faith. I felt like something big was inside of me, you know, giant inside of me, this willpower, this fearlessness. And going to college and making, you know, getting out and earning $40,000-$50,000, it didn't feel like it was enough. So I dropped out of college and I felt entitled to more money. I thought, you know, I should be making $40,000-$50,000 a month. I imagined myself super wealthy and I imagined myself big, bigger than I had been. And it's interesting because this was the beginning where when I stabbed my dad, I was changing my story. Up until that point, I'd been a put upon little kid. And at that point, I became a heroic. When we went to the foster care facility that night, all the abused kids, all they wanted to do was hear that story. None of them had stood up to their abuser. I had. And I knew that that story carried great weight with it that first night. Not only because it was dramatic and cinematic, but also because it meant that I was different than them. And they knew I was different, and I knew I was different than them. And that's what came up a few years later. Like I said, I felt this sense of entitlement. Like, I'm different than all of you. I have something in me. I can change my story. I can move. I can innovate. I can improvise. And I could do it to my advantage. And I could, you sort of trade up. And so I wanted to make money, and was very angry. And I decided I wanted to go do crime because I could make money that way. And so it started off small, thieving. Sense of entitlement. I didn't want to work. I just wanted to take it. I want people to give me things. They weren't giving me fast enough, so I started taking things. I started little petty robberies, bounce checks, stealing a car eventually. Over time, I was wanted five counties, so I left to Mexico. You know, I thought I was a little badass, 23 years old, doing a little crime, 24. But I got robbed in Mexico, $30,000-something. I had, you know, like $800 to my name. I was like, damn, man, I need to make more money. And that's when I decided that I would rob banks. And the next day I came up to the United States and I robbed my first bank. Fortunately, I didn't get arrested for that bank robbery. The next day going into Mexico, they stopped me at the border, the highway patrol. And they arrested me for the warrants that I was wanted for, in five different counties in Southern California. So, I went to prison knowing, wow, I had done bank robbery. That was easy, $4,500. So I was there for almost 2 years and waiting, thinking, I know what I'm doing when I get out. When I get out in January 1988, I know what I'm going to do. I might wait a couple of weeks because I don't want to go back to prison right away if I get caught right away. But I'll wait maybe 2 weeks, a month, and then I'll get into it. And that's what happened in January 1988. I was 26 years old. And I went on a 14-month bank robbery spree in which I robbed 30 banks. Now, this is the interesting thing. When I was in Mexico and I got robbed, and I realized I had been kind of like I had been robbed by real criminals, I wanted to become a bigger criminal. I've been a petty criminal up to that point. And I didn't like that. I didn't like that the men in Mexico read off me weakness. They read off me vulnerability. They read off me that I was a low-level criminal. I was suspicious and sketchy, but they knew that that was just I could get played by them, and I got played by them. And so I wanted to ratchet up my game. And turning myself into a bank robber put me in an entirely different league. And there's another occasion where I innovated with my story. I tweaked it and said, okay, my level of crime was not good enough. I need to amp it. I need to make it a little bit more cinematic, a little more dramatic. I need people to hear bank robber and think different than purse snatcher or snatching somebody's keys and taking their car. That it's a different thing, a whole different kind of crime. So turning myself into a bank robber was the next innovation. And it did. I got to prison. I was a bank robber. I went to federal penitentiary, maximum security penitentiary. And I committed crimes. I ran with guys who were mafiosos from all over the country. You know, Rastafarians, Colombians, Italians, Irish, the Dixie mob, white supremacists. Being Mexican, I just ran with all the Mexican gangsters on there. So, you know, I was trying. I really had this anger still. I had this rage inside of me, easy access. I had learning. I had books. I had literature. I had all those effete things from before. But at this point, I put aside all my knowledge and thinking. I was now just living by my loins. I was just a man of action. I wanted just my body to behave in the world. I didn't want to think about ideas. So I was in there for the first couple of years running crazy. Running with a group of guys who were really kind of bad. And, you know, moving like that. And then my ex-cellmate was murdered. And I was put in a solitary confinement under investigation for the homicide with five other Mexican men. And you could read all about this in my memoir, The Man Who Outgrew His Prison Cell, Confessions of a Bank Robber, where I go into what happened in solitary confinement. It reduced me. It broke me. It halved me. It humbled me. And I changed my life after about a year in there struggling to keep sane. Had a hallucination, a breakdown, which ended up being a breakthrough. And I gave up. I gave up the fight. And it wasn't I just gave up being a criminal. It wasn't just, oh, when I get out, I don't want to rob banks anymore. It was actually, I want to be at peace. I want to find out who I am. I knew enough from my learning to know that there was an idea out there that we could become more whole, that we didn't need to act against our conscience and against ourselves, that there was a way in which you could achieve balance. People called it spirituality. People said you could find it through prayer. I had all that language, but that had proven ineffective over the years. Nonetheless, I was still attracted to the notion of a whole man, somebody moving in concert with everything they had, and utilizing it without judgment, but mostly just trying to achieve balance. And that's what I wanted because I knew my life had been so off kilter and I was unhappy, utterly unhappy in solitary confinement. And so I quit. I was let out after, like I said, 2 years. None of us were involved in the murder. They found the guy who actually had done the murder. He was still living out in the general prison population. They arrested him, let us all out. And I quit. So for the last 3.5 years of my sentence, the second half of my sentence, I basically started reading and writing writing my story, trying to get to what had happened and chronicling all the stuff that I've just told you, trying to write the stories down as story, not as ideas, but just what do I remember happening? Once I laid it out on the page, these things which had all been discrete memories bumping around in my brain and periodically being triggered, and I would remember something and I would get angry or I would get sad or whatever. Once they were organized on the page, I could see all these patterns of my life. It's crazy. I could see that some things where I had thought had originated here in 1973, it turns out that when I wrote these stories out, I actually started my money obsession much earlier. I started my rule breaking much earlier. I could see the origins of things now because they were in place next to things before them and things after them. And then something had occurred in that moment. It was really fascinating to learn about myself by now having it on the page. And that's where I got the concept of I'm changing my life by owning my story. And I came out of prison. It was one of the first things I talked about. It's how'd you change? I said, I owned my story. Mm-hmm. I started an organization in 2008. Promoting the concept of own your story. That was the name of it. Own your story. Because if you own your story, it doesn't harass you anymore. It's not in your head. These discrete memories that can just pop up and all of a sudden you're off kilter again. I really began to see where I got angry, the origins of my rage, the origins of my misogyny, the origins of my racism, the origins of it all. It was right there. And then I did the work to try and I read some things on mindfulness. I read some stuff on language, metaphors we live by the linguist, linguistics professor at Berkeley, George Lakoff, went into my cell. And when I read that book, it blew my mind because I understood that everything that I was trying to do in terms of change myself was I was trying to change the way I talked about myself. And that's what I had learned from the little Buddhist readings and this linguistic stuff. And that is where I worked on. I focused on that. How am I thinking? What's the metaphors I use to describe myself? And how are they traps? I worked really hard on this stuff, and I'm writing a second book on this right now. But so I got out of prison in 1996, a changed man. And when I got out, the last 2 years of my time in prison, I had a correspondence with a man, a writer named Richard Rodriguez. And Richard Rodriguez and I talked, and first couple letters, he says, hey, you're already a writer. When you get out, I'm going to help you publish. So when I got out, I wrote a first piece 3 months out of prison about how I was scared of that 90 days coming up, because the first 90 days is when guys mess up and go back. And I wanted to make it a 90 days so badly. I wrote that piece for the San Francisco Examiner. An editor at the LA Weekly read it, and she said, will you write a longer piece for us? And I did. 1,500 word essay for them. She became the op-ed editor at the LA Times and asked me to write an op-ed in 1997, 9 months out of prison, when these two guys went into a bank in North Hollywood, a Bank of America, and they robbed it, and they walked out with guns, just blazing the cops. It went international, this story. The cops came around. They were just shooting at the cops and shooting cops, and it was this big Terminator kind of thing. They're just walking down the street shooting a cop. I wrote an op-ed about that because everyone was calling it a botched heist once these guys got killed. And I said it was a successful suicide. And that got me 48 hours. And it launched my TV career in terms of being a talking head on crime. I would get to places like Nightline and CNN and eventually arguing with Bill O'Reilly about the Scott Peterson case. That's what I did. That's what that helped. But it also got me writing about writing op-eds in almost every national newspaper, with the exception of the New York Times. And so that's what I did. I got tired of writing op-eds. We wrote the memoir. It got published in 2004, 8 years after I was out. And I've turned to writing scripts and turned to writing workshops. And really, most importantly, besides being a father the last 7.5 years, almost 8 years, has been the work that I do trying to help women find their voices. A friend of mine has this op-ed project named Katie Orenstein, a good friend of mine. When she launched it, I was there trying to help her help women develop skills and use their expertise to write op-eds so that we can have more female voices, thought leadership on the op-ed internet, on the national op-ed pages. But I've done a lot more mentoring in juvenile hall, young writers, females in and out of prison, and the writing workshops I've conducted. When I was a bad man, the worst thing, the thing I regret the most was the emotional abuse that I did with women who loved me. I wasn't a physically abusive man, and that's not to say it was better than emotional abuse, but it's one of my greatest regrets. In fact, the bank robberies, my greatest regret is not that I robbed banks, because I did time for that. It's actually that I really, this rage that I took to the tellers was ferocious, and I didn't even need to pull a gun. I would just menace them enough for them to panic and give me all the money. And to see those faces, to make somebody that reduced by your aggression, is a really, it's a horrible thing. You know, I went out and made victims after I had been victimized. It's really a painful, painful regret for me. And I can never do anything about it. I can't approach these women and say, let me be, you know, please accept my apology. But I do live a life now in which all the work that I do and emphasize is to try to promote female voice and thought leadership. And now I have a daughter, and so that's where all my energy goes there too. My creative energy is trying to make her strong enough and confident enough so that she will usurp my voice one day. And I, the advantage of being an older father is that I don't have as much ego involved like my dad did when he was young. And he took so much of what we did personally. I actually look forward for her to, you know, take over. I want her to have as strong a voice and a ferociousness that I have. And I try to cultivate that in her. Anyway, I'm trying to do work in Hollywood. But in the process, you know, I'm trying to do many things, but I'm working on that writing. The interesting thing is one of the people that I helped write and encouraged to write was Piper Kerman, Orange is the New Black. And you were a husband. And when she went to prison, none of us knew that she was going to prison. And then she went, and we all knew she was there. And I was asked to send her my book. So I sent her my book, and then we started a correspondence, just like I'd have with Rich Rodriguez, in which I told her, listen, all your friends, they love you, and all of them know you better than I do. But none of them know what I know you're going through right now. And here's how I can help. And she would ask me things. She would tell me things she was going through. And I would encourage her. And that voice, knowing that I knew what she was going through out here, and me being a stranger, I understood what that was like, because Richard was my stranger. And you could talk to strangers differently. And that's how our friendship grew. And I told her, write a book. Write a book. You need to write this stuff down every night. Write something funny that happened to you, you heard. Or write something, and write something sad that you heard, or dark. She got out. And she still wasn't sure she wanted to write. And me and other friends, we did our work on her, like, you got to write. Turns out when the book got published, I didn't realize it, but there I was on page 277 or something. One of my letters to her made it into the book. And that was, I was instrumental encouraging her to write and eventually write that book. And it was really brilliant. Last week, we were at Stanford together and in front of, you know, 600-700 people, having a conversation about her book and the story and prison life. And I moderated a question and answer, and we had a conversation, and it was beautiful. It was amazing. I'm sorry for these noises.
No worries.
Let me turn that down. Anyway, so that's where my life is. That's where I focus on. You know, I'm constantly trying to help people with their story. I learned about story by innovating with my story. And that's my greatest advice to people is, once you own it, once you put it down on paper, you can see it, the patterns of your life. It's there. It's not just these memories bumping up against each other in your head. It's right there. And write it as articulately as you can, with as much detail, the images as you can. And born from those details, you'll find some emotions in there that you've forgotten, or you will label them correctly now. You labeled them wrong before. I remember discovering I hated somebody and thought I loved somebody. And I realized as I wrote it out that I hated them. Or some people I hated when I wrote about them in the thing, I realized I was already halfway in love with them. You don't know these things when they're just memories in your head. But when you write out the narrative, you can really accurately identify the emotions in your story. That was helpful. But I also tell people that my life is a perfect example. It's like I embody the notion that you can innovate with your story. Mm-hmm. It's one thing, but it's never locked. You're never locked in it. You can move this way. You can move this way. You could tweak this. You could tweak that. And your story is this fluid thing. When you own it, then you can innovate with it. And then you can game it. That's my next concept. That's the next book, the idea of gaming your story. And I will go into that in my book about how part of changing my life was realizing my identity was fluid and saying, okay, how can I create some propulsion to move it in that direction? And that's what I call gaming your story. It's figuring out exactly the things you need to do to move it in that direction so that you become this different person. It's not performance. You don't want to pretend to be somebody else, but you actually can change in very elemental ways and change back to who you were to begin with that we've moved away from, you know. Anyway, all that's to say, I'm living the dream. I'm doing good. I'm a happy father. I'm proud of my daughter. I'm happy with the work that I do. I'm continuing to write. And as you know, you read that piece that I did for Medium, which is a very popular piece, more popular than I ever imagined it would be. There's people who want to know about this topic. Mm-hmm. And Piper has opened up the subject in a way that's become more conversational to talk about the criminal justice system. A lot of stuff going on around criminal justice issues, you know, legalizing weed and not sending people to prison for weed. And now there's this big thing about the death penalty. A lot of people are revisiting that. Just a lot of things in that the orange is the new black house, because it's that fish out of water story, and people are willing to think about prison. What would I do if I was in there? Because this great Netflix series implicates people that way. It's really beautiful and wonderful. Anyway, I'm super optimistic about my life. I'm in a great place. I'm happy. I'm far away from those years, you know. I'm 17 years out of prison now.
Wow.
This is the 18th year. And in July, it'll be 18 years. So it's a beautiful thing. I'm here. You got what questions you got?
I'm sitting here, you know, obviously I am trying to balance listening to this amazing story and writing down whatever questions I have. That's why I didn't want to say a word or interrupt you at all. I have a ton of questions. I want to go back to the very beginning of this, mainly because, you know, the interesting thing about somebody like you to me is I see this really fascinating dichotomy of how you were on two potential paths. Somebody who, you know, potentially could, you know, clearly was very religious, but I mean, you seem like you lost your way. So I want to talk about a couple of things in the very early part of this, if you don't mind.
No, of course.
One of the questions I want to ask is about the loss of a mother. I mean, I can't imagine such a thing, especially as a 9-year-old child. And the reason that I ask about loss a lot is it seems like this is something that is a running theme. Loss and pain seem to be almost common threads between all our guests. And
one size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together.
J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and t-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
You know, having been somebody who actually was negatively affected by that loss, it seems, you know, I've seen both sides of this coin where somebody has been very, very negatively affected by a loss, but for others, it becomes a catalyst for making positive changes. And I think you're really the first where it really, you know, led you down somewhat of a dark path. I'm curious, you know, when you talk to people about loss, when you talk about these kinds of traumatic experiences, even how do you get them to process something like that so it doesn't send them down into sort of a downward spiral?
Well, you see, the thing about it is that everybody experiences grief. That's just the way it goes. You know, you have grief when you first rejection, love rejection. Everyone experiences grief. But grief hits people differently. If you've been told that, if you've not been educated how to handle your emotions, then and you also are full of self-loathing, then grief is going to hit you, and there's an alchemy that's going to occur with the grief that's going to make it tricky to manage and get through without hating yourself, blaming yourself, or not even trying not to deal with it and creating all sorts of, you know, self-sabotaging things so that you can have these defense mechanisms so you don't have to deal with it. There's that people. That human material is out there. And then there's other human material who have love and strength and home and consistency and safety, and they've been well fed and they've been told that they're pretty good, and they have a good, you know, they have solid, they you know, they doubt themselves sometimes, and sometimes they hate themselves, but overall they have a sort of healthier approach to life. When they get hit with grief, and if they've been taught how to that their emotions are natural and work through them and process them out, and here's how we do it as a group, let's go to church, like have some semblance of handling them in a healthy way, then grief is going to ripple through them differently, a different alchemy, in which they'll get processed and work through, and they'll come up with strategies to deal with it through healthy religious practices or whatever, meditation. They'll do it. So we're working with, there's no one person who's going to be hit by grief. There's several ways of, there's different types of human material when grief hits it. And the one I usually work with are people now who've been through prison. And most of them have been traumatized before they got to prison. They didn't get to prison because they were healthy-minded. They got to prison because they were abused. There was a lot of grief in childhood they didn't manage. There was a lot of morbidity, a lot of death around them. Gang members killed, family members killed. They saw a lot of blood on the streets. They were brutalized. Those people, grief hits them hard, and it hits them tricky, and they end up dealing with their grief through violence, which then creates more grief in their life because they're acting against their conscience. And then it also allows them to get into drugs. That complicates their life because they have to do more things to act against the conscience. They move farther away from being able to get to the origin of this behavior. That's the people I work with a lot, and it's super challenging to get them to go there because there's so much cloudiness there. Mm-hmm. But I do have friends who didn't have any of that. I had a friend, she lost her firstborn son to leukemia, and she had two daughters and a baby boy when he died. The baby boy, when he turned five, he got leukemia, and he fought it off. And there's a chance, like the 15-year-old, it could come back, and he could die too. She lives with the grief of the firstborn, with the knowledge that the second one could happen to him again. She lives a lovely, open life. She has these cafes in LA called Death Cafes, where people go and talk about grief in healthy ways, and they work through it. If you saw her and met her, she's so positive and optimistic. You would not know that this woman was once devastated by grief, but she had a lot of love growing up. She bounced back from it, and she manages it, and she approaches life with a bunch of strategies that work for her. Mm-hmm. So there's no one thing about like, here's how you handle it.
Sure.
You have to deal with the material in front of you and kind of listen and learn what the grief was, how it rippled through them. If you have an imagination like I do, I can think of ways how we might get them to begin talking about it. In my case, the reason it worked badly for me is that when I cried after my mother died, the religious people around me were so uncomfortable with my crying. They told me not to cry because my mother was in heaven. In fact, I should celebrate because she was absent from the body, but she was present with the Lord, which created in me a conflict, because it was natural. Emotionally, it's natural to grieve the loss of your mother. That's your elemental connection to the planet. I was in her womb. We had connected by umbilical cord. We shared the aunt's blood. That's a big dislocation from the universe to occur. I needed to cry. I needed to suffer. But what they created in me was the occasion to feel my tears now were selfish, because I should be celebrating her presence in heaven. And it made me feel inferior as a spiritual being. And it created the occasion for me to despise my own nature. That created confusion in me, emotional dissonance. What I know now, a child comes to me crying because her mother died, I'm never going to say some nonsense like that to make them move further away from themselves. They need to integrate tears and grief and pain into their life, know it's healthy, so they can move through it. Because in those emotions are beautiful strategies to get you out of it. If you're joyful and you hug someone and you laugh, and you, that the emotion carries with it its own intelligence. Hug someone, laugh, and it's out. If you're sad, you know, cry, yank out your hair, pound your chest, get it out of you. It has an intelligence, and then it works through you. Eventually, works through you. That was the thing with me. It got all my emotions got clogged. Nobody gave me any language that had any dexterity, any subtlety, you need to move in this area with a supple intelligence. None of the people around me had that. They could not help me. And I was a very sensitive child.
Wow.
And already at that point, I had enough understanding to know that something was wrong here. I couldn't articulate it until I grew older. But does that answer your question about how?
Yeah, absolutely. I love this. I mean, it's really, really just mind-blowing stuff. And like I said, I have a ton of other questions. One of the things that you brought up while you were telling me that, you know, sort of the whole story of what's led you to today was, the early sort of literary influences in your life. Mm-hmm. And that's actually quite intriguing because, as I said, I mean, it's such an odd parallel. Like, you know, when I imagine the life that you had, I don't imagine a young boy. Like, if you tell me that story, and you didn't tell me the literature part, I would never imagine the literary part. And I'm very curious kind of how those literary influences that you mentioned have shaped, your own story and your own view of the world as you've gone forward with things.
Well, a lot of people ask me, how did you, solitary confinement worked for you. We should put everyone in there then. And I tell them, no, the difference between me and most of the people who go in there, and actually solitary broke me. So it was both the worst and best thing that ever happened to me. It was one of those paradoxes. But one of the reasons I could survive it and get out and move forward with the life that I have today after being so negatively impacted by my experience in there was that I went into prison with resources that most people don't have. Private education, language resources, the books all day long, ideas. I was trained to look for meaning in things. And I was given language. I was, it had philosophy. I understood how to create arguments. I knew story arcs. I knew the redemptive story. I knew all that all day long. So when I could turn to my interior world, I had resources in there. One of them, you asked, how's it affected my story? Well, in the beginning, I saw it quickly as a Jonah story. I just saw it as, okay, Jonah, God called him to do something. He rebelled. He started going the opposite way. And God said, all right, I'm just going to throw in a fish and he's going to spit you back on the shore where you need to be. I thought that that's what my story was. It was a simple, quick acting against what God wants you to do. I quickly realized, though, that if I was going to change, it wasn't going to be with God. So that story changed, but I could still keep a redemptive arc, because you could have redemption stories that don't have God in them. It's just, you know, it's a redemptive arc. And so I thought of my story that way. Like, I'm, you know, prodigal son returns, you know, and is humbled and is willing to do whatever to get right with his community and his family. And in that case, with his father. So, you know, I had stories that I could kind of say, it works this way. Let me think of it this way. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, as I matured and started working with my story more and more, you know, it becomes many things. You know, I'm breaking my story down now all the time. It's part fiction and nonfiction. I'm merging fiction and nonfiction with my story as I think about turning it into a film. Mm-hmm. This entirely new way of blurring those lines. Because I've written memoir and I tell my story, I understand that memory is fluid and porous, and there's a lot of other things. Anyway, storytelling becomes even more sophisticated than the rudimentary Aesop's fables I was working with in the beginning. But I'm able to think about story that way because I had literature, mm-hmm. because I had ideas, and because I understood I had language that I could grow off of. So when I started reading Foucault and other people talking about language or whatever, other ideas that were a little bit more postmodern, I got them, but I didn't get them in an academic didactic way. I thought, how can they mean something to me in my life? How can I turn them into, you know, feed them into the coal of my engine so that it continues to move me forward and it drive me? It's part of the, you know, locomotion of my story. So ideas and thinking was very, very crucial for me to have had that training as a kid. Now, I also had Greek and Hebrew under my belt because my dad always wanted us to grow up and translate verses. So I could read Greek even when I was in prison. And I was laughing at a friend in the letter one. I was like, look, I haven't written the Greek alphabet in whatever, like 20 years or so, or, you know, 18 years. But there I was writing. I can't help it. Some of that stuff has always just stayed with me. And I'm grateful to my father for that, because my dad actually provided me rigor. And rigor is important if you want to be a writer. You have to be able to sit your ass down. You need to be able to grab an idea and fight it onto the page sometimes. You just need to grapple with it. And you need to stay there and you need to keep thinking, how can I make this as sharp as possible? How can I hone this argument? And I was doing that stuff very early. Mm-hmm. So it was certainly helpful. But also in literary ways, it wasn't just how can it help the process, how can it help technique. It was important when my father was reading to me at night, and I was in ninth grade, and he's reading me Kafka's The Hunger Artist. I write this in the book. I knew there were things in that story, and there was things in that moment being read to by this man who brutalized me, but was reading this lovely, amazing, far out, you know, absurd story to me. I knew there was something there I would one day get. I didn't know it was irony. I didn't know a lot of things, those words yet in ninth grade. But that feeling that, like, I'm going to pursue knowing what this is one day, I'll know it. I was on the lookout for seeing meaning in stories and that sort of thing. So when I changed my life, it was like, okay, what is it meant to now? Mm-hmm. What does this mean? What can it mean? What did it mean in the past at one time? One of the things that people like about my writing is, because I'm a different man, and I know what I was like before, I lived on the other side of taboo for so long. I can see how I saw something way back then very well, very clearly. And I could show you how I looked at it then. And I could show you how I look at it now. And the insights are surprising to people. Because I could tell you exactly when I became a misogynist. I could tell you exactly when there's things I could tell you about and why, from that perspective, I looked at women this way, why I exploited them this way. It's in the book. It's in the middle of the book where I call the asshole chapters. It's where I was a really bad guy. And I break it down. Mm-hmm. I break it down. I observe. I let you see. Here's what my thinking was in that frame of mind. And so now when I talk about things, it's always with an understanding that my ideas have migrated over time. And I know the migration. I can recognize and spot it and highlight it.
Wow.
Precisely because I know that stories change. Because I know that things, meaning changes. And what things meant to me before don't mean that to me today. they mean something else. Anyway, that's where literature was really great. And wow, having my dad and mother expose it to me was really helpful.
Amazing. So even more questions, from this part of the story. That is such a mind-blowing perspective on literature and reading. I mean, I love it. It seems like the running theme throughout our conversation has been that your story is one that continually evolves. So, I want to dig deeper into the story itself.
Absolutely.
There's two sort of things. I mean, I feel like the moment when you stab your dad is sort of a crossroad between two choices. I'm either college-bound or I'm bound for a life of trouble. And
it didn't look like, actually, it's actually something different. But I mean, it is two choices.
Yeah, please tell me. I'd love
one. One is, and I'll break it down more in terms of aesthetics. One is I continue to be the one who loves language and loves books and loves literature and the arts and thinking and abstraction, and I'm living away from my body because I have no ownership of my body. I'm just a punching bag, but at least my mind will be be pursuing the violin. I was playing the violin, and I was what I call my quote unquote like my effete endeavors, or I can become a man who owns his body and lives by body. In simpler terms, I'm becoming a man of action, a doer, not a thinker, not somebody who postulates and theorizes. That was what I was going to be, a philosopher, a theologian. That's what I wanted to be. I wanted to be sitting there with my glasses and behind my desk and safe. Or I could be my body and be dangerous and just do and live like I'm just going to act now. I'm tired of being put upon. That was a choice to me that day, more than anything, because that's exactly what played out over the years. I didn't know it at the time. But if you look at it, it was very clear. When I would think about, I could think like that, I would laugh. Forget thinking. Do. Subvert thinking. That's what you used to do. You used to be a thinker. Now just be a man of action. Be bold. Be brave. Run through your fears. Thinking was a place where you could hide from your fears. Thinking was a place where you could hide from action. All you're doing is competing with a bunch of other nerds and geeks. Don't do that. Come over here and compete with real men. And understand the codes of Mayo codes. Learn how to spit far. Learn how to laugh loud and obnoxious. Be a man. That was what was happening to me on that day. What was I going to be? Was I going to be a feat? Or was it going to be a doer?
Wow.
A thinker or a doer? That's what it was to me.
Amazing. So on that note, I mean, you chose the path of doing, which obviously led to a lot of interesting things. But one of the sort of common themes throughout all of this, from everything you tell me, is ambition. Like, it's clear, but it's misdirected ambition. And that's what I'm curious about is sort of, you talk so much about owning your story, and it seems to me like you wanted to own the story of I'm a doer. I'm somebody important, and it's interesting. I think that we all have this sense that it's something there, right, inside of us, that it's almost that childhood dream type of thing where we all have this sense that we were put here to do something that truly matters, something that's going to make a difference in other people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the way it played out for you, I mean, you got to it in a very sort of roundabout and almost self-destructive way. But I'm curious, in that moment of saying, I'm going to rob banks, what's the story there that you're telling yourself? And I have really absurd questions, obviously, because this is a world that I'm completely unfamiliar with. I mean, as you're actually going through robbing a bank, I mean, what is going through your mind? Does it give you a sense of power? And how do you get away with it? That's the sort of silly question.
No, I want to go to your first question first, real quickly. The way I looked at it is this way. Growing up, I was abused and brutalized and put upon. And I decided, I'm not that guy, man. I'm bigger than this. I knew in my heart that I was big, and I didn't know exactly how big, but I knew one thing. I was not supposed to be beat up like everybody. That's just a victim afraid. That's not supposed to be me. I thought I was a giant. But evidence, didn't support that. So it was incumbent on me to become the giant I thought I was. And in prison parlance, I coughed up a nutsack and I went and I became a man. I stabbed my dad, tried to kill him. Thought I had killed him for several hours, actually, and changed my life radically. I altered my story. I became a doer. I became somebody who could put a marker down for the rest of my life and say, I am unimpeachably brave. Boom, look what I did. Nobody does this. They continue to get beat up. They grow up and they beat up their kids and their wives and their dog, but they do not try to kill their tormentor in childhood. I did. It marked me. Now, then I became a petty criminal. I'm like, what am I doing? I'm bigger. I'm a giant. I'm not supposed to be petty. My story is supposed to matter. Who I am is supposed to matter. Even in the criminal world, I just got robbed by criminals. How did I not see that coming? Well, I'll tell you why. Because I'm small. I'm petty, but I'm not supposed to be. Let me tweak this story. Let me innovate with it. And let me become a bank robber. Let me become this thing that's mythical in the American consciousness. We romanticize the bank robber. Every Hollywood hunk has played a bank robber. I mean, when Dillinger was killed in that theater, outside the theater, he was watching Clark Gable play a bank robber. So since then, we've had Rob Redford and Paul Newman, and then the next ones were Robert De Niro and Al Pacino, and then after that was Clooney and Brad Pitt. Everybody plays a bank robber. It's the most romanticized criminal character in American consciousness. I became that. And now I was like putting a thing down, boom, I will be unimpeachably cool for the rest of my life because I am now a bank robber. I'm not a serial killer. I'm not a baby killer. I'm a bank robber. And so that was changing my narrative again. But then I go to prison, I get locked up, and I'm looking at 99 years for this homicide that I didn't do. And I'm like, I'm not supposed to end up in this cell. This is crazy. How the hell did this happen? I'm supposed to be somebody. I innovated again, and I changed my life to become this person. I said, I'm supposed to be a writer. I'm going to be a writer. Screw all this nonsense. And I innovated, and I became the person now who comes out and is able to get on TV, is able to lecture, is able to write books, and able to educate people about their story and empower people and inspire people. And this is where I was supposed to be. I went the long way around, but I got here every time by innovating with my story and trying to direct it to be larger and have more impact. That I want to get, that's out of the way. Let's talk about the banks. I'll give you a quick thing about going to banks. Driving to every bank, it doesn't matter from the first day to the last one, your body wants to rebel. Your body knows you're putting it at risk, putting it in danger. And this is what I loved about bank robbery, because on the way there, when my stomach would get knots, everything in your body that happens when you're afraid, it happens in my body too. The difference is with most people, not with you, because I know you surf and you have to overcome your fear to surf. You got to charge that wave that can kick your ass and kill you even. So I know you know how to marshal something and push through the fear to make something happen, to get to that place of balance or peace or satisfaction, whatever you're going for. But most people, for the most part, when they confront fear, they back off, especially a fear that's so radical that it makes you afraid that if you die, if you keep going forward, you might be extinct. And that's a possibility of bank robbery. You walk out, and there's a bunch of cops, and they shoot you dead. Your body understands this. So once you go down, you get a headache, my jaw clenching, sweaty, my hands are just can't move. You know, jumping off the steering wheel, I want a wave of fatigue goes over me, so I can almost pass on the side of the road. Pretty intense, very intense experience. What I needed to do is I needed to get angry. I needed to summon my rage by thinking of things that had humiliated me in the past, you know, from bullies from childhood all the way to my dad and, you know, the stabbing. And then this monster would rise up in me, and a level of peace, you know, struck me. You know, came over me that was transcendental, man. It was spiritual practically. I was no longer afraid. In fact, I felt I could just handle. It was endorphin high or something. It was something. I just felt like I could handle anything. I felt like a giant. And I would go and direct that rage with great efficiency and make it through those banks. I just marshaled my intensity. Took it into those places, and just with my words, I can march them to the vault. I could just make them give me money. I can make a couple tellers do. Once I was so dissatisfied with the little money that this little bank gave me, that even though the cops were on the way out, I just walked in the bank next door and robbed it too. I was that. That's how fearless I was, and crazy, which is partly what that fearlessness is. But that's what it was like. You had to push through the fear.
Wow.
And I did.
You really, this is just mind blowing. So I have one more question around this, and then I want to kind of shift gears a little bit. There's a few more questions I have specifically around sort of the media work that you've done. You know, one of the things that has been an ongoing theme throughout our conversation is this notion of owning your story. And, you know, it's very near and dear to my heart because it's something that I've realized, it took me a long time to get okay with that. And I realized, you know, what do people come and do on the Unmistakable Creative? They come and own their stories. I think that's really, you know, one of the things that is what makes this so appealing to me and why I love the people who come to this show so much. You know, the thing that I'm finding as I'm talking to you is it seems like if we're stuck, owning our story is such a fantastic way to get unstuck. And people who are caught in stories that are not serving them, I feel like that's kind of an epidemic of our culture today. And I'm very curious, kind of, you know, what advice you might have for them. I mean, and the funny thing is, I doubt that their circumstances are anywhere as near as dire as the ones you've been in.
In fact, mine was tougher to change because I had to really do a lot of work on myself, years and years and years to change. Mm-hmm. The problem I find the most people with owning their story is they look at story as a static thing. I look at story as a fluid thing. And I look at story as a thing to play with. I look at life as being playful. The strategy for anything is to play. That's why gaming your story was such a big thing for me. The reason people have a problem, bottom line, with their owning their story is they're too attached to their story. By that, I mean too much ego is involved in story. One of the best things that happened to me, and I'll give you an example of what I mean by game your story right here. And this is almost a meditative approach to your life story than anything else. When I was in prison, I started realizing very early in my change that I used to think that people did things that made me angry. And there was a very big, and you know, I write about this in the book and I write about it in various essays and I've talked about it a lot. What the biggest thing occurred when I realized in solitary confinement that I got angry, very, very, very angry and I want to hurt someone, but nothing had happened to me. Nobody had said anything, nothing. And I realized it was all in my head. But I had a rage like I had never, you know, as big and bad as anything I'd had before. And so what I did is I went in my head and said, okay, what was I thinking about? And I traced it a couple thoughts back and I found the origin of my rage in my thought. That blew my mind. I realized, oh my God, it's just like, it's my thoughts. It's how I perceive things. That's what's kicking off the rage, not what's happening. I've been blaming people. I've been blaming circumstances. I've been blaming it all. And it works to our advantage to think that other people are the reasons we don't succeed, we are making mistakes, we're angry all the time. And I used to tell my girlfriends, why'd you make me get angry? You knew that was going to get me angry when you said that. You must have wanted me to get angry. I would blame them I blame the victim, you know, for my insecurities. All that to say, eventually I realized, tracing this over and over in solitary, the origin of most of my rage was wounds. I could easily find that I was wounded all the time. I got hurt all the time. I got angry. I got scared, felt helpless. I got angry. Weakness underwrote my rage. And I was like, oh my God, all these years, my ego's been telling me, oh man, I'm a good guy. Other people are messing me up. They're throwing me off my game. So finally, when I got out of solitary confinement and I knew that I had this tendency to, you know, this really volatile temper, I wanted to play with it a little bit. So I would go down the chow hall, and it's easy to feel, quote unquote, disrespected by people in prison, just like it is to find all sorts of ways of getting disrespected out here and then feeling like you're obligated to do something about it. So before I would go to the chow hall, I would tell myself, okay, somebody's going to do something there that normally would have gotten me very angry. And in the past may have been a reason for me, it would have instigated action on my part. Somebody may have given me a broken cookie. Somebody may be giving me the last watery part of the Jello instead of a fresh, you know, solid Jello scoop from the next tray. Something, I would feel like they thought I was some sort of weakling and some shitty prisoner or something. And then I would have to, like, hey, man, you better respect me, and throw it in their face and then get locked up in solitary confinement. That kind of craziness, right? But this time I would go down there and say, okay, who's it going to be? Is it going to be the lasagna guy? Is he going to give me a corner piece rather than the next piece, which is a nice big piece from the middle? Is it going to be the Jello guy? Is it going to be the cookie guy? Like, I didn't know, but I would try and tell myself, who's going to mess up? And then I would say, okay, it's going to be the lasagna guy. I'd go down there and it would be the cookie guy. And on the way to my seat, I'd be like, ah, I thought it was going to be the lasagna, but it was the cookie guy. But distancing myself from my insecurity And knowing that this in the past would have been something that upset me, I was able to play with it. And I knew that these are things that weren't in themselves things to get me angry. I chose in that instance not to be angry by something that in the past would have gotten me angry. And at that point, I just kept doing it with my life, and I do it today. I mock my seriousness. When I start getting angry, I laugh at myself, because I know if I'm angry, it's really disguising a wound, and I'm puffing myself up, and it's ridiculous. And so I mock that ego. Most people are stuck in their stories because their ego is stuck in that story, and they take themselves too seriously. You want to play with your story, you got to take yourself less seriously. You have to be willing to play with it. You have to be light, because owning your story and innovating your story means you need to be nimble. You need to know that certain things that you thought mattered about you, they really don't. Those things that you think, oh, I'm really that person, you really might not be. That might be exactly the reason why you're stuck, because you're actually thinking you're this and you're not. You've thought that all your life, and if you really investigate, you're going to find out you think that because people told you that. That's not really who you are. Getting away from being stuck is really investigating and playing and trying to be nimble with your identity. And that means that someone like me, who is very important for people to take me very seriously, I like it when my daughter like calls me annoying. That is another way for me to say, when my dad would never have let me call him annoying because his ego was too thick. I don't take myself so seriously that I get bummed out when my daughter says I'm annoying. I don't care. I just, it's not who I'm fine with who I am. And I know that's not who I am. And that's the way I might be perceived. And that might be the attitude for the day, but I do not lock into that nonsense. And so that makes me more able to move. I don't get stuck. That's my big thing with people. And I find it all the time.
Wow.
And you get somebody in front of me and say, I'm having problems changing. I really want to change. I will test how much they really want to change by helping them investigate how seriously they take certain things of their life, which are where they're stuck, you know, which is where they're rooted and they can't move around that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then I say, well, you got to be willing to laugh at yourself here.
Yeah.
It's very, very challenging. For people to laugh about things that they take very seriously about their identities.
Wow.
Then you realize you might not innovate as much. Those of us who have seen how often we've been insecure and silly with vanity, we're just like, okay, I'm ready to move away from that. That's I'm ridiculous here. What do I need to do?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like entrepreneurs constantly moving or moving because they're like, okay, I messed up. I failed on that one. What's the next chance I get to fail? Where can I really work? They're not afraid to go out there and try to like innovate and fail again. That's what you have to almost be with your spirit. You know, that's mm-hmm. what I believe. I could be wrong.
Mind blowing. All right. So let's do this. Let's shift gears a little bit. And we'll start wrapping things up here. I mean, part of how I found you, was, you know, first we had Meg Warden here, which really, you know, was a paradigm shift for me personally. And, you know, my perceptions of what people who go to prison are like, I thought, you know, I mean, and, you know, the media obviously does a certain job of portraying what people are in prison are like. You know, you watch Shawshank Redemption and you think, my immediate thought, I'll tell you very candidly, I thought if I ever got sentenced to jail, I'd kill myself so I wouldn't have to go. And then, you know, I get to hear the story of somebody like Meg. And then, you know, that leads me to you because of the article you wrote on Medium and kind of what our perceptions of life on the inside. I mean, you of all people probably have even a more interesting story, a more powerful story or a more crazy story than Meg's was, even because you were in a maximum security facility, which sounds nuts. Like when I imagine maximum security facilities, I think of movies like Con Air, things like Shawshank. And so I'm very curious, sort of kind of, you know, what are our misperceptions that are being shaped by the media? And, you know, for people who have not been in prison, you know, one of the things that Meg said to me, she said, you'd be really surprised who's in there and you'd be surprised. There's some really nice people in prison, you know, and so I'm very curious about this from the perspective, especially given the nature of the work that you do.
Well, I can say a few things. One of them, you know, because you read my article, one of the things that when I was writing about Orange is the New Black is that we're funny and a lot of humor behind bars. Guys are very, very, I mean, prisoners are funny, darkly funny. I remember, you know, I was there for 3 days, and the maximum security prison, this big, I mean, gigantic biker guy stands up, big muscle, big tattoos. He puts his fingers under his armpits, each, you know, like, and he starts waving, moving his arms like he's a bird in flight. And he's like, quack, quack, I'm a duck. I can't call games worth a fuck. He does that 3 times and he sits down. And I wonder, what the hell was that? And I say to the guy next to me, he says, those are called quack quacks. When guys bet here, they sometimes will bet for money, but sometimes they'll mostly bet for money or, you know, cigarettes, whatever. But sometimes to embarrass somebody if they lose, they will bet quack quacks in the chow hall. That guy lost a bet last night. He bet a game and he lost. And so his bet was that if he lost, he would have to do 3 quack quacks in the chow hall. And then I, you know, for a couple of years I was at that prison, periodically you would see quack, quack, I'm a duck, I can't call games worth a fuck. And that was, and we'd all, you know, chuckle and go back to eating. There was that kind of stuff there all the time. So the humor was a big thing. In fact, when I came out, my friends were like, Joe, write about how funny it is in here. I write about the humor. So there's that. The other thing too is that most people think that falsely you are the crime you committed for the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. I guarantee you, Srini, if I got a video of you of the 4 or 5 minutes of the worst things you've done in your life, where you acted against your conscience, where you did things that your worst regrets, and I played that to people and said this was you, 20 years later, 30 years later, you would say, hey, wait a minute. You know, I call bullshit here, man. Those were like 3 or 4 minutes of the worst things of my life all put together. That does not compromise my identity. That's not who I am. And yes, I feel bad about them, but that's not who I am. The same thing with men who's a murderer. I had a friend who got drunk, cracked, smashed a bottle over somebody during a bar fight, killed the man. 20 years later, he's an AA. He's a changed man. He's leading all these groups. He's religious. He's a lovely human being. And he goes there, and the victims and the DA don't let him out. He's a killer. He killed one person, and it took exactly 10 seconds. That's not who he is the rest of his life. This is the big problem, is that we hear somebody did something, and we want to lock that in as our identity for the rest of their life. You wouldn't want that in your life, and yet we do this to people all the time. And you could see how patently unfair it would be. Even my father, I don't make him the man who broke my bones. If you read my book, I'm very generous with him. And to this day, when I was there in LA 2 weeks ago having dim sum with him. Took a friend from Norway to have dim sum with my father. I love that man. I call him all the time. More regularly, our conversations are, hey, Dad, I just realized another thing that you gave me that's helping my daughter. Another way in which you were a good dad. Thanks. I didn't see it before. I see it now. Because my dad did a bunch of great things. He acted against his conscience a few times in very dramatic ways, cinematic ways, as I say. But the majority of the time, my dad was a loving, generous guy when he wasn't demented with rage and out of control, which was less than the good. So in my head, I don't lock him in. The mistake I made growing up is I made him a monster. Mm-hmm. And then I looked at myself as being a monster because I did monstrous things, because he did monstrous things. My dad was not a monster. He's a human being who acted against his conscience, and I made him into a monster for the rest of his life until I stopped. But he's not. That changed. Same thing with the guys in there. They're not locked into what the crime they committed. For the most part, most of them are not. And some of the crimes, the majority of the crimes that guys did in there should not even be considered crimes. The majority of the people are in there for drug crimes. You know, they were using drugs or they were selling drugs. Mm-hmm. And most of those drug crimes in my book, they don't belong in there. They belong in treatment or they belong somewhere else, but they don't belong in prison. Right. So there's that. The other thing is, of course, the kindnesses. Mm-hmm. Because there are people in there, they realize they're in there for the rest of their life. They want to live a life. You say, if I had to go in there, I would kill myself. The big secret is how much beautiful life exists with men who are never getting out. A sort of peace over time comes over them and they realize that's their home. And they have to give a shit about it. Mm-hmm. They care. They're mindful. They try to like avoid problems. They gather together. The safest population in there, the ones that do the best, are the lifers. They're like, they counsel people. That's their world now. That's what they have to find meaning in. Wow. And they find meaning there. They counsel the youngsters. They lead the AA and the NA, and they go to church, and they raise money for, you know, so that they could give to some cause, out some kids dying of leukemia on the street. They raise money. Guys who have little money on their books, you can donate money. They're the guys who do that kind of stuff, you know? It's crazy. They care about their lives. Their lives have meaning. They are not the guy they were when they were an angry 19-year-old drunk. They're now 39, 49. They're trying to live a good life. And so you find decencies in there all day long. You know, I go to my bed, my cell. It's my birthday. It's the night of my birthday. And there's a can of Dr. Pepper on my desk and a Snickers under my pillow. Like, who does that? Prisoners. That's who does that. Decency, man, all day long in there, all day long.
Wow. Well, Joe, you know, I mean, we've gotten probably well over an hour, but I didn't want to stop you because this is truly, truly been mind blowing. I can't thank you enough for doing this. So I'm going to ask you my final question. I mean, you're a writer, and our show is called The Unmistakable Creative. And, you know, we've suddenly entered a world of noise in which everybody has a voice. And given, you know, your story and everything that you've been through, the question I have for you is, in a world that we live in, full of noise, how do you become unmistakable?
You call it unmistakable. I call it unimpeachable, which means it has to be authentic. See, I walk into any room, and there are some things about me that are unimpeachable. You can say whatever the hell you want, and you cannot touch my narrative, because I've lived it, I've done it, I demonstrate it, I live and breathe it. And the thing that you need to do as an unmistakable creative is you have to be driven to live an unimpeachable life, to do something that's unimpeachable. It is so clear once you've done it, and nobody can touch it. People can say all they want, they can sling stuff, but then you end up being Gulliver and they end up being Lilliputians, and you're totally uninfected by their little arrows hitting your ankles. You can give a shit. And the rest of the world will know that they're Lilliputians slinging little, you know, bullshit arrows at your ankles. That, to me, is you have to find out what it is about you that makes you your most unimpeachable self, and you have to be fine with it. Because your unimpeachable self means you're going to have to be also find your frailties and your vulnerabilities and live within them too. And that investigation and that willing to put yourself out there is a big thing. There's a lot of people who want to put themselves out there all day long. YouTube is full of those people. We get it. But they're unimpeachable all day long because they don't know who they are. They're performing. They're doing something. What I'm talking about is something so – you've heard me use the other word, elemental. Something so – and I'm not sure – you know, I'm not like literally element that we're – these things are elemental. But in a lyrical way, you have to get to a place that is so almost fundamental, as fundamental to you as you can be, that nobody can take them, that nobody can say anything about it, that nobody can say you're being false. And it will come through. I guarantee when you are you and you get in front of people, they're going to know that they've been in front of some dynamism that they don't generally bump into in the world. And, you know, I found myself and I got fine with myself and I move in the world like that with a confidence. You know, it took, you know, many years. And it took a lot of tears and it took a lot of wanting to give up. But I'm here now. And, you know, we're in an advantage because the great thing is there's this new medium, the internet, in which you can do a lot. We don't even know what we can do. It's not even all the way known. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of ways in which we're seen. But, you know, we're doing things. I'm doing things. I'm looking at it. And I'm paying attention to it. But it's available to us there. There's people who are really looking for something that's true. There's a lot of falseness out there, but there's a lot of people who are more interested in what is true. And if you are unmistakable and unimpeachable, people will come and find you because it's a big world out there. You know, one of the great beauties of my story is when the documentary protagonist, which was made by Academy Award winner documentarian Jessica Yu, when that gets people see it on Netflix, I get contacted from all over the world. When they see the even the cheesier, our episode from I Almost Got Away With It, Investigation Discovery, when they see that on Netflix or they see that on TV in South Africa or Kenya or Jerusalem or Ireland or Tokyo, they want to reach out to me too. My story, there's people out there. They want to know. They know. And the great wide web, man, the wide web is opening up all these options and opportunities for us to be unimpeachable and get recognized. And I'm excited about that. I love that. And story, it's all about we can play with story now in ways we've never been able to play before. It's so much fun. We really can innovate with our stories so much more now.
Awesome.
And that's what I think. That makes sense.
That makes all the sense in the world. Joe, really, I can't thank you enough for being here and taking some time to share some of your story and your insights with our listeners at Unmistakable Creative. You know, I'd said at a certain point this year, I have gotten to a point with my ability to do this where I have an intuition for things that are going to be a really, really big hit. I think you're going to hear a lot from our audience. This is
boringly. Okay, my friend. Hey, listen, this was wonderful. I love your style. I've never been interviewed where people didn't have like questions coming in. I love that intuition. Stick with this. It works. I like that.
Awesome.
It's been wonderful being interviewed by you, Srini.
Thank you. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us. And for those of you guys listening, we'll wrap the show with that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.